The people of El Salvador, of Guatemala, Honduras, they usually leave for one of two reasons, not because they want to, but either because they are fleeing some harm or because they simply cannot satisfy the basic needs of themselves or their family if they stay.
This is Vice President Harris on Monday afternoon during a White House event. Her analysis is consistent with results from a recent Migration Policy Institute report. It's a unique, in-depth analysis of the complex reasons for regional displacement and migration across Central and South America. And the report finds, quote, violence, insecurity, and natural disasters have been complex and longstanding triggers of migration, but economic factors were participants' primary motivation for desiring to emigrate. Now, back in March, President Joe Biden assigned the vice president to lead the administration's response to migration at the southern border, with a specific focus on addressing the root causes leading so many to move across national boundaries. In response, Vice President Harris has been corralling private American companies to invest in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, or the Northern Triangle, with the goal of jumpstarting sustainable growth in these local economies. On Monday, in an event co-hosted by the State Department and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in collaboration with the Partnership for Central America, the VP announced that her office has secured $1.2 billion in private investments for the region.
The work of this group of leaders in this call to action has been the work of addressing one of the main reasons that they leave, and that is the lack of economic opportunity if they stay at home.
Okay, that's the top line. But dig down in the White House press release announcing some of the details of these new investments, and you'll discover some very big names offering some very, let's call them, modest and indistinct investments. There is Microsoft, a company whose third quarter revenue was $45.3 billion. Apparently, they have, quote, catalyzed the development of digital access training centers. Okay. There's MasterCard, with just under $5 billion in third quarter revenue. And the White House brief indicates that, quote, MasterCard has partnered with Walmart to enable access to credit for underserved citizens. And yep, PepsiCo's there. Now, their third quarter beat expectations and came in at $20.19 billion in revenue. PepsiCo has promised to, quote, spread regenerative farming practices across 7 million acres. And you may not immediately recognize the name Parkdale Mills, but the company, based in my state of North Carolina, is the largest privately owned yarn spinner in the U.S. They make the cotton that becomes products for companies like Lands' End, Jockey, and L.L. Bean. Now that's more familiar, right? So Parkdale Mills has committed to, quote, build a new yarn spinning facility in Honduras and to expand an existing one. Together, these two facilities will likely create about 1,000 jobs. For a bit more context, according to reporting from Vox, 2019 foreign investment in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras totaled about $2.2 billion. That same year, migrants from those nations who found work in the U.S. sent back $22 billion in remittances. And so, take a trip with me to a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas, a place marked by my skepticism about the likelihood that MasterCard, Walmart, Microsoft, and PepsiCo are about to create more just, inclusive, and robust economies in Central America. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and on today's Takeaway, you've just crossed over into the Side-Eye Zone. Oscar Chacon is Executive Director of Alianza Americas, who specializes in U.S. Latin American relations and migration. Oscar, welcome to the Side-Eye Zone.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Melissa.
Now, is the Biden administration's approach here a step in the right direction, or is this just about big companies expanding their profits with low-wage workers?
Well, ironically, I would say it's both. It's a very, very minor step in the right direction. But there is no question in my mind that in the end, we are essentially replicating what has been part of the problem in Central American countries, specifically Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Namely, you know, the problem with direct foreign investment is that it's been very, very small, that it basically reinforces the very economic basis that have allowed for so many people not to be able to fulfill their basic aspirations for a decent way of life, raising families, you know, with a degree of prosperity. And that is what I'm afraid this particular initiative may not help undo, simply because there are no reasons to suppose that this is going to come out any different than in the past, you know, we have seen. I believe that one of the challenges for the U.S. is that they need to understand that the necessary measures will require, among other things, to really identify a new set of rules and a new set of players for direct foreign investment to actually have a chance to make an impact and ultimately change, you know, the way these countries have functioned, sadly, for more than, you know, two centuries.
When you make that point about repeating the kinds of investment we've already seen there, I mean, I have to say I was a little gobsmacked about the garment industry or the yarn spinning in Honduras, in part because, I mean, American college students were organizing against multinational corporations like Nike for their labor practices in Honduras just a decade ago. And now we have the White House actually celebrating what appear to be very similar jobs as though they are a meaningful departure.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that it's very interesting to look, you know, from a longer time frame to foreign investment. I recall very well that back in the 1970s, U.S. corporations that came to invest in Central American countries actually got in trouble with the local economic elites because they wanted to pay better wages. They actually wanted to give more benefits to workers, but local economic elites would basically say, you are absolutely doing the wrong thing. You are making these people become too lazy. You're giving them too many perks, and you need to do business the way we do them. And the way they do business, ironically, today, is the way global corporations tend to operate at the global scale. And it is because it ensures much more profits at the end of the day. And I think that that is, again, one factor that would need to change very dramatically if we are to see countries like these ever become places where people truly don't want to live from, because they are places that are pleasant, places where people can actually provide a dignified way of life for themselves and their children. But that's not what is happening now, and I don't have any reason to assume that what I just announced will actually point us in any different way.
I'm also interested in why the Biden administration has accepted the premise that U.S. interests are best served by actually curbing migration to the U.S. This same policy report that I talked about a bit earlier actually suggests that one of the ways to improve the economies in Central American countries is actually to expand legal pathways for Central Americans to migrate into the U.S. basically on short-term legal work visas, since the remittances are you know, tenfold more than the investment to actually sort of allow those remittances to flow, but to have them flow to public works projects rather than simply to individual households. But of course, that would create more incentive to migrate to the U.S. But that could be good for the U.S. I guess I'm wondering about this idea that closing the border is what's best.
Well, you are absolutely correct. I mean, and I think it's important to understand the Biden administration has found itself completely trapped by a desire to do things differently when it comes to how to handle migration, but at the same time, refusing to once and for all divorce from a narrative that has painted migration and migrants as some sort of evil that we need to neutralize. If you look at the facts, migration has been vastly positive for the United States of America. And if you just look at remittances, it's been also pretty good, you know, for thousands of households in Central American countries that are the recipients of these remittances that are sent from the U.S. So the first thing that we should do is not to assume that bringing more foreign investment and fundamentally changing the economic rules in these countries is something we need to do so that there is no migration. Because the fact is, we have been the largest beneficiary of migration from these countries, Mexico included. But we need to also understand that the drivers towards making life better in these countries should not just be stop migration, because I really believe that that's the wrong approach. I believe that one more powerful reason for why we should be indeed casting a different economic approach in Central American countries is because of the larger changes in geopolitics. You have now China and Russia absolutely looking at these countries as places where they want to gain more influence. So a larger, more important question for the US should be, what can we do as the largest power in this hemisphere to absolutely make ourselves a better proposition to countries like this, other than, you know, what China or Russia may be pushing through? And let's be frank, I mean, those other countries don't have any problem working with dictators if that's the partnership that they consider better for their interests.
You know, obviously, there are key economic reasons, but these political questions that you're drawing our attention to are absolutely crucial. And I'm wondering about, how is it that corruption, or at a minimum, right? So corruption may be at a maximum, but at a minimum, at least anti-democratic or non-democratic governance in these nations also affects sort of what this kind of private investment can even accomplish.
To tell you the truth, I mean, I think that a lot of these private investors, which, as you well pointed out before, compared to remittances, are a little dwarf because they are so small, but they often use the very corrupt nature in these countries, the very sick ways in which economic elites and political elites have gone about handling foreign investment to their benefit. And that is something that we must also strive to change. Let's take the case of Honduras. You know, everyone knows that Honduras has become, over the past 12 years, essentially a narco state. But many foreign investors don't have a problem, you know, coming into Honduras, so long as they can get away with whatever they want. And they don't mind, you know, working with corrupt politicians that are very known to be linked to narco-trafficking gangs throughout the hemisphere. And so I believe that part of what we need to understand is that a lot must change if we are to see these countries become better places.
Oscar Chacon is the executive director of Alianza Americas. Thank you so much for your insight and your conversation today.
It's been my pleasure.
The United States spent $725 billion on national defense in fiscal year 2020. That's a number that far outpaces defense spending by other Western nations in total dollars and in percent of the national budget. But even while U.S. taxpayers were making it rain on the Department of Defense, military families are going hungry. According to the Military Family Advisory Network, one in eight military families faces some form of food insecurity. The network also indicates that nearly a quarter of military families with school-aged children report that their children receive free or reduced meals at school.
As a soldier, you don't expect for your family to have to go hungry.
Rotisha Adams is a veteran and a current military spouse. She serves as community outreach chairperson with the Fort Hood Spouses Club. When I spoke with Rotisha, she told me about how the constant and often unexpected moves associated with military life generate significant expenses that can create or worsen food insecurity for families.
A PCS move is a permanent change of station. So that's when the soldiers go to a new duty station for an assignment. And during those moves, families, you know, they have to pay for food on the way. They have to pay for hotels on the way. And sometimes a lot of the spouses or the service member don't know how to get reimbursed for those costs of moving and providing food to their families. Sometimes, you know, we move from the West Coast to the East Coast. That's like a week's trip to get our families there. So for that week, we're, you know, footing the bill for food, housing, things of that nature. So, it takes a toll on the income.
She also pointed to the ways that a military code of service and self-reliance can sometimes deter those in need from asking for help.
There may be families who are still going hungry but are too prideful to go and get that help or to ask for help.
I also spoke about food insecurity in the military with Shannon Razadin, the president of Military Family Advisory Network.
Food insecurity is essentially when you are worried or concerned about having enough to make ends meet related to food. And so as an organization, when we've been looking at food insecurity among military families, we've used the USDA's 6-item short form food security scale to help us not only figure out if families are food insecure, but also where they're falling on the spectrum of food insecurity.
Let me start by asking if this is a relatively new problem. I can absolutely remember I'm coming from kind of a working class, you know, community in Virginia. I had friends who right after high school enlisted in part because it was their sense that being in the military meant that they wouldn't have these kinds of insecurities. Not that it would make them rich, but just that they would have some basic security around housing, food, and the ability to kind of move into adulthood without the kind of terror that a lot of young people were facing, especially if they weren't going to college. About how to make ends meet.
Absolutely. And so when we look at food insecurity, it is not a new problem for military families. COVID, of course, has made it worse for many. But when we've been looking at this over the last few years, we've seen that this is not a new phenomenon. When we first started hearing about this from our advisory board who worked at a food bank down in the Norfolk, Virginia area, she was telling us of families who were coming in regularly to get food support. And so our research team in multiple national studies took a look at this, and we found that before the pandemic, 1 in 8 military families nationally who responded to our survey was experiencing food insecurity. When we drill that down into specific locations, we found that in some areas like Washington State, that number went up to 1 in 5. And then in Virginia, North Carolina, and Texas, that number was at 1 in 6. Then when we took a step back and found that during the pandemic, that number nationally went to 1 in 5. And so as an organization, we know that COVID has, of course, exacerbated this issue, just as it has for many people across the country and around the world. But we also know that we need to get food to families immediately while we work to develop long-term solutions.
Now, food insecurity is a crisis for many communities, but help us to understand the ways that military families might be even more cut off from the, some of the solutions and or at least the kind of social safety net that we have. Why aren't these families eligible for SNAP and other federal food assistance?
This is a really complex issue for military families. And I'll start with the SNAP component, which is often known or referred to as food stamps. Because the basic allowance for housing is factored in as income, most military families are not eligible for SNAP. They are eligible for programs in many cases like the free and reduced price meals program at schools and also WIC, but we're seeing families show up and apply to get support through SNAP and they're turned away because that basic allowance for housing is factored in as income. So there are policy solutions that are in the works right now as it relates to the Farm Bill and other legislative efforts to try to pull the basic allowance for housing out so that it's not a component of eligibility for military families. But as you look at the landscape and what military families go through, military families move on average every 2.5 years. And when you have that constant restart, it's really hard to understand the landscape and what resources might be available on a local level. And that coupled with issues with military spouse unemployment, which has been a perennial issue, it's really been hard for military families to get that second income that so many of us really rely on. And so you look at things like childcare, you look at things like the frequent move, military spouse unemployment. You know, when you take that step back, it's not all that surprising that military families would be having a hard time making ends meet. We're seeing the highest frequency of food insecurity among our junior and middle enlisted families who have children. And so as we've been working on solutions related to this issue, we're seeing a lot of families. We launched earlier this year a 1 million meals challenge to provide the equivalent of 1 million meals for military families over the course of the year. I'm proud to say that we have passed the 800,000 mark and we expect to hit our 1,000,000th meal later this month. But as these drive-through events, you'll see cars filled with children going through. And we're trying to create an environment of fun where people can, one, get the support that they need. But this month, they're meeting Santa. Last month, they got hand-painted pumpkins. And we're trying to really support these families and celebrate the fact that they are seeking out this help and support because it is so important.
So on the one hand, I appreciate it. My heart kind of, you know, leaps up in joy of the idea of kids not, you know, feeling bad or stigmatized in this line, but like it's an opportunity to see Santa. On the other hand, I think, is there some reason we're just not paying our enlisted members enough that, especially if we know that they've got to move and as a result, their spouses are going to have, you know, difficulty with, you know, finding employment long term. And if they have young children, right, making it that much harder. Why don't we just pay the people in our military enough so that they can purchase food or trip to Santa or whatever else is necessary?
Right. So the compensation package is absolutely a component of this. The GAO released a report earlier this year that took a look at the basic allowance for housing too, and how in many locations it's inadequate. So basic allowance for housing is designed to cover 95% of housing expenses as well as utilities. But for many places, it's not even getting close to that. So you look at high cost of living areas in some cases where military families are, and you see the food insecurity component too. So it's a very complex web, and we're excited and grateful that the Department of Defense is now looking at this issue. But in the meantime, while these policy solutions are being worked on, organizations like the Military Family Advisory Network are really stepping in to fill that gap.
So this is a great point that when we look at our current federal leadership, obviously the Biden family in a very personal way, right, is deeply connected with questions of not only veterans, but of active duty military. Do you have a sense that the Biden administration, as well as kind of on the legislative side, are looking for and partnering with you and other advocacy organizations to find solutions?
Absolutely. So Dr. Biden has outlined food insecurity as a priority area in joining forces. And so this issue does have the attention of the highest levels of government. And that's because the data is there. That's because we've been able to put a spotlight on this issue thanks to media attention and opportunities like today. And we're grateful for that and know that these solutions are not going to happen overnight and know that this problem is going to take a long time to resolve. But we are grateful that we have this high level of attention and that we've been able to because of the support of people who are passionate and who firmly believe that military families should not have to worry about where their next meals come from. That has allowed us to really fill that gap in the meantime.
I got to say the first time that I became sort of aware of the level of need with military families around these questions is in my work with the North Carolina Diaper Bank and the level of diaper insecurity that military families have. I'm here in North Carolina, and our Cape Fear, Fayetteville sort of military base area diaper bank serves primarily actually military families. So I'm wondering if there are other needs so that the food need is clear. You've talked a little bit about whether or not that housing allowance is sufficient. Are there other clear needs facing our military families that we just need to be sure the public is aware of?
A lot of it, when you think about the moves that are happening every few years, military families, and during the pandemic in particular, need to feel like they are part of a community. We see loneliness and the connection between loneliness and issues like food insecurity. And so there's an opportunity for people to introduce themselves, to help military families get acclimated to a new town, a new community, a new school, new sports team, and just being aware that military families are in your community, that we are moving often, and this life is incredibly transient. The other piece that's really important to note is there's a culture of resilience among military families. And so there's almost a suck it up, buttercup mentality, and the thought that there's always someone who is a little bit worse off than you. And so by encouraging people and celebrating people when they get the support that they need and when they seek out what their family might need help with, that's a great thing. And that makes it easier for others in the community to get that support too. And so offering the support before people have to ask for it is always a good step in the right direction. And it helps to lower that stigma for so many.
Shannon Razadin, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we are switching gears. So go ahead and get comfortable, because we're going to get philosophical as we ask a question that will soon be considered by the New York Court of Appeals. Are animals persons? All right, one thing is for sure. Many of you have noticed that your own beloved pets have acted in ways that have you thinking that these little critters may be more person-like than we always admit.
Hi, my name's Karen Sater, my American Bulldog. He's a big dog. He weighs about 80 pounds. And one night, I was laying in bed, sound asleep, and I started to have a nightmare. I started crying out and flapping my arms around. Frank jumped up on top of me and laid full body on me to comfort me and protect me from whatever it was I was dreaming.
And as a guardian to many furry and feathery little ones, I have a lot of stories about my moody cats, my eager pups, and my broody hens, who can most definitely count the number of eggs that they're hatching in a clutch. But do the thoughts, feelings, or even surprising skills of an animal render that animal a person in a legal sense?
Happy the elephant is a female Asian elephant who is confined at the Bronx Zoo in New York and has been there since 1977. She was born in Thailand about 1970.
This is Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Jill recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic, which pursues exactly this question. What does it mean to be a person? And is it possible that an elephant, in particular, an elephant named Happy, who's living at the Bronx Zoo, is a person? The Non-Human Rights Project, kind of think of it as an animal ACLU, has filed a writ of habeas corpus, or a claim of unlawful detention, on behalf of Happy in an effort to get her rehomed to a sanctuary. Now, right now, you can only use a habeas corpus petition on behalf of a person. So the petition was rejected by multiple lower courts. But now, the New York Court of Appeals has agreed to hear the case in early 2022.
So lawyers looking for test cases are looking for the best possible subject for their case, one that they might not necessarily even be able to win, but that will call the strongest support behind their cause, right? So think about the ACLU using John Scopes, the high school teacher in Tennessee, to bring forward the case regarding his possible prosecution for the crime of teaching evolution in Tennessee, which was against the law in Tennessee. The ACLU, you know, just was looking for someone in a state where there was a law that someone who's willing to be tried for breaking that law. Or I think of Happy's case in relation to the famous 1960s Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia, but the case of Richard and Mildred Loving, a mixed race couple who were charged with violating Virginia's miscegenation laws for being a married couple. It was a great case because they were an incredibly appealing couple. They had a very loving marriage, but it also helped that their last name was Loving. So I think in some ways, honestly, and this is a slightly cynical reading, but in some ways Happy is appealing to the lawyers arguing for her case because of her name, because she's, you know, the case is about happiness. Is it possible for an elephant in captivity ever to be happy? Or what kind of suffering are we actually talking about here? But so then you might ask, well, okay, why elephants? Why elephants? Why consider elephants to be persons? Well, partly that's because if we think about personhood in the vernacular way, like when we think about a person, right, someone who exists and has a mind and a soul and a personality, right, like in a colloquial sense, that's sort of what we mean. Like, which animal is most person-like? You might think of a chimpanzee. This organization has, in fact, tried to advance personhood claims with chimpanzees without success. But actually, you might think of an elephant because elephants' social relationships are so profoundly moving. They're so deeply tied to their families. They have a very extraordinary social intelligence that I think humans watching elephants have, you know, for thousands and thousands of years considered a likeness. I think humans look at animals and animal social life and say elephants are like us. that's not necessary from a legal vantage at all, right? A corporation is a person. A corporation isn't like us. But an elephant is surely more like us than a corporation. But it's necessary from communicating to the public the need to protect the rights of animals, not by acting on their behalf, but by granting them rights as creatures, as beings, as independent beings. So there's something person-like about elephants in that way. And then with this particular, so there's maybe we get to, okay, she's got a good appealing name. Elephants are very appealing. They seem to be like us. They are loving and they are capable of joy and happiness and delight. And we can see that when we watch them and put on YouTube and look at elephants. But then why this particular elephant? Well, one very good reason is that she was part of a landmark experiment that was conducted in 2005 and published in 2006 by a scientist who studies sort of comparative cognition in animals. She passed this test, which had been designed for chimpanzees much earlier, called the mirror self-recognition test. That is to say, in a verifiable empirical experimental setting, scientists could prove that Happy, this particular elephant, can recognize herself in the mirror, knows she's looking at an elephant that is not an actual elephant and not a reflection of just any elephant, but a reflection of her very self. And that passing that test is seen as a possible measure of the capacity for empathy, right? A level of social intelligence that we don't see in other animals. Chimpanzees can pass that test. Humans can pass it as toddlers, but not before. And elephants can pass it. And it may be that certain dolphins can. And that's it. It's hard to test animals. It's hard to ask animals questions, but elephants can answer certain kinds of questions. And this is one question that Happy happens to have been the first elephant to pass this test.
And in part, as I'm reading, and I think as so many of your readers must feel, you have this sense of, okay, I get it. This elephant and elephants as a class of beings do seem to be unique. We do have a kind of shared sense of cognition. And then I think also as you write about their sense of community, the fact that they grieve, but also as you write, if I didn't know I was reading about an elephant, I might think that I was reading about a person who'd been, or a human who'd been trafficked. You know, where she's born, the purposes that she's used for, the way that she's used to entertain. It does read not entirely unlike a young girl being snatched from her mother in Asia or in Africa, brought to the U.S. and used for the entertainment of the wealthy. And this, I guess, is both where I felt the sense of empathy, but also bristling and wanting to reserve some particular space for a human person who experiences that. And I have been kind of back and forth with myself about this. Is that wrong to want to still carve out something particular about a human experience of enslavement while not necessarily denying that there is a experience of suffering on the part of the elephant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know just what you mean about that unease. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this case is this particular legal maneuver of filing a habeas corpus petition for the release of someone, a person unlawfully confined, was used by abolitionists to advance the cause of abolition. So that when people who escaped enslavement and made their way north were captured by bounty hunters and put in prison, abolitionists filed habeas corpus petitions saying this is a person who is unlawfully imprisoned. And it was a part of the legal step required to establish the personhood of people who had been enslaved or who were being enslaved, as opposed to their status as property. Animals are property, right? Happy is technically the property of the Bronx Zoo. She's not a person. But that was, in fact, the legal status of people held in human bondage in the United States into very recent modern times, right? So it's the connection there is not, it's certainly not one that you're imagining. It is a very deliberate reuse of the methods used by abolitionists in seeking this case. So, and then you might say, okay, well, that's somehow demeaning, right, to people who are both persons and humans, as opposed to non-human animals, to class them together in this way, to use the same legal strategy. Well, I happen to think it's ultimately not. I mean, first of all, one of the things I learned about working on this piece, which I had never really understood before, not really being a historian of animals, is how much sort of the capture and display and torture and public execution of elephants took place very much in the shadow of Reconstruction, the abandonment of Reconstruction, the rise of Jim Crow. There is something, some deep and deeply troubling way in which the history of the elephant really is tied to the history of enslavement and sort of deep brutality in the history of the United States. So there are historical ties to be made there. But ultimately, I think, I guess I came around to thinking, I'm not interested in collapsing the distinction between humans and other animals analytically. But as a historian, I think I wanted to take seriously the idea that if animals can be legally persons who can be rights-bearing persons, then we should understand their lives better at the level of biography, that we as a historian are like the next step then is well to take seriously the idea that this, you know, all animals aren't just a category of animals, but they are also individuals. And what is it? What would it mean analytically to take that seriously and try to tell a life story? But I don't think that moves into in any way making like lowering the boundary between what we might distinctions that we need to think carefully about.
We've been talking about the legal case of Happy the Elephant, who could be granted legal personhood by the state of New York in 2022. But if you've been thinking that the term personhood sounds familiar, it's likely because the personhood movement has been a powerful force in American politics for more than a decade. Not in the arena of animal rights, but on the issue of abortion. In pro-life circles, there is an interesting intersection between fetal rights, personhood politics, and an elephant. It's an intersection that meets in the pages of Dr. Seuss's 1954 classic, Horton Hears a Who. It's the story of Horton the elephant who works overtime to save a tiny planet in a speck of dust. No one else in Horton's world thinks these tiny invisible whos are worth all of the noble elephant's effort. But for Horton, the calculus is different.
And even though you can't hear or see them at all, a person's a person, no matter how small.
So perhaps it's not surprising that the legal case of Happy the Elephant has attracted the attention of Catholic theologians. Back in February, a handful of Catholic theologians submitted a brief to the New York Court of Appeals in support of declaring Happy the Elephant as a person. And given that the U.S. Supreme Court is actively considering a Mississippi case that could overturn Roe v. Wade and eliminate 50 years of legal precedent protecting the right to an abortion, I wanted to understand if the New York Appeals Court's willingness to hear the case of Happy the Elephant could establish a new legal basis for also understanding a pre-viable fetus as a person. I asked Jill Lepore about precisely that issue.
Yeah, personhood is a quite explosive notion. And you could equally say we would be distressed to see the courts granting personhood to a non-human animal at a time when human persons all over the world are unlawfully confined with no possibility of release or remedy because of profound structures of injustice that affect people all over the world. And yeah, I think the answer to both is we don't decide questions of justice based on other questions of justice. You know, I don't think this is an easy case by any means. But I do think it is one that we are required to examine. We are required to examine it in the context of moral obligations to one another and to the natural world and to our notions of law and justice and charity. And we can't pretend that this case doesn't exist because it's inconvenient for other judiciary priorities that we might have. That's where I finally came down. Like, I'm not an animal rights person. This is not my life. This is not my cause. You know, I'm a political historian, but I have come in looking at this case carefully to believe that it is a necessary part of the political journey in the history of humankind toward granting rights to more than just the people in power, right? Mm-hmm. Historically, mm-hmm. rights are those that are, mm-hmm. kings have rights, then nobles have rights, then maybe commoners have rights, then maybe peasants have rights, then maybe eventually women have rights, then maybe children have rights. And only after all of that do people of different skin color held in bondage maybe possibly have rights. Like, we are in a long moral journey as a species. And I think we have taken some terribly, terribly bad turns on this road. So this is a turn in the road that I think we need to look at carefully and try to crane our necks and see what lies around the other side of that corner.
Let's go back to the case for just a moment. What is the Bronx Zoo saying?
So the Bronx Zoo, should be said, is run by an organization called the Wildlife Conservation Society, which happens to be one of the world's leading conservation societies. They do an enormous amount of work protecting species during this, our biodiversity crisis and age of mass extinction, protecting species and habitats all over the world that are endangered, including Asian and African elephants, and have been a real leader in protecting Asian and African elephants in the wild. The Bronx Zoo says that the case is really a PR stunt. It points to the sort of celebrities involved and the sort of thin Twitter campaign that is, you know, annoying and celebrity driven and all the things that the Bronx Zoo says about it, I think are probably fairly stated. So on the one hand, they sort of are dismissive of the sincerity of the Non-Human Rights Project interest in Happy's actual condition. But on the other hand, they stand by that they know what's best for this particular elephant, that, you know, maybe that there's a fairly widespread consensus that elephants do not do well in captivity and in general should not be held captive. And most American zoos have released their elephants or ended their elephant programs or are winding them down. The Bronx Zoo says that while they may agree with that or be sympathetic to that position, this particular elephant who has been in captivity since he was less than a year old and who has been at this zoo for decades now, again, since 1977, and who they say has a history of not getting along with other elephants and therefore must be alone. So what is called solitary confinement by the critics of her confinement, the Bronx Zoo says is a necessary protection of her and that she is indeed content.
What is at stake if the court were to find that Happy is indeed a person?
So the Bronx Zoo has secured a number of amicus briefs from organizations that say what's at stake is your ability to get the next generation, say, of a COVID vaccine, which will be tested on animals. And if animals are granted personhood, in this case, it will extend to all animals and then all animals at laboratories where vaccines are tested on animals. Anybody could file a habeas corpus petition demanding the release of those animals in biological laboratories and virology labs. They say that, so the pharmaceutical industry has filed an amicus brief in support of the zoo. There are legal scholars who suggest that if Happy is found to be a person under the law, factory farming could be shut down. Animals that are living in conditions of confinement in large agribusiness would be by law required to be released. So I don't find those arguments persuasive, but that is a claim that is certainly out there and one that your listeners who are interested should examine and contemplate, right? That if animals are persons, we can't eat them would be, you know, mm-hmm. sort of the reverse of the Aristotelian notion that since animals don't have syntax, we can eat them, right? Like the whole sort of history of Western philosophy is we can eat animals because although they can communicate, they don't have syntax. So they're lesser, right? They don't have souls, or the Descartes notion that animals don't have souls. This actually, if the court were to find Happy to be a person, that challenges this whole, in the West, this tradition. Now, in other parts of the world, and actually in indigenous law, it's quite common for animals to be granted personhood. And in other parts of the world, animals have been granted personhood without these huge effects that are the bell ringing of the other side. What would be the consequences is hard to say. And in fact, the Non-Human Rights Project has been asked that in previous cases where the courts have been necessarily quite cautious to say, like, we might be sympathetic. We think this, we are persuaded on the matters of fact that this animal, this elephant, would be better off in a sanctuary than in this zoo alone in this little 1-acre enclosure. We agree with that, but we can't grant her personhood because we don't know what the effects will be. That seems to be, you know, what the lower courts have generally said. In this case, what the lower courts have said is we can only kick this question down the road for so long. I mean, at some point, the road comes to an end. This actually is a question that the law must answer.
Jill Lepore is the David Woods Kemper Professor of American History at Harvard University and staff writer at The New Yorker. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's all we have today, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Come on back tomorrow.